flaw in the diamond.
What in the world just happened at J.P. Morgan?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, May 11th.
Coming up, everything you need to know about J.P. Morgan's big loss and why it matters.
Also, are consumers loyal to their favorite brands anymore?
And why are teenagers in court today fighting climate change?
We'll explain on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Ever since the financial crisis of 2008, one of this country's major banks has looked pretty good in comparison with all the rest. That would be J.P. Morgan, which didn't lose the kind of money on mortgages that its peers did. Its leader, Jamie Dimon, is known by some as the King of Wall Street.
Well, after the stock market closed yesterday, his crown lost a little bit of its shine. Or you could say he fell off the throne altogether. Dimon announced his bank has just lost $2 billion, and the culprit appears to be bad bets involving J.P. Morgan's selling insurance contracts against losses on corporate debt.
These were egregious mistakes. They were self-inflicted. We were accountable. And what happened violates our own standards and principles by how we want to operate the company.
It's also not the way some people want any bank running a business. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now on the implications of all this.
The fallout from J.P. Morgan's surprise announcement of big troubles in its derivatives trading is just beginning. First, financial, as CEO Jamie Dimon said in the conference call.
We've already said it could get worse, and it's going to go on for a little bit, unfortunately. That's number one.
Dimon acknowledged there could be another $1 billion in losses this quarter due to volatility in markets. Dimon insisted that the derivatives bets taken wouldn't have violated tough new banking regulations that go into effect this summer. The so-called Volcker Rule would restrict the ability of banks to trade with their own money. Bank analyst Nancy Bush says this debacle for a huge Wall Street bank is also a debacle for those opposing tighter bank regulation.
Any pushback to a Volcker rule is now dead. And remember, Jamie was the leader of this charge. And I think it's made it much more difficult for the industry to say, you know, it's not dangerous.
Simon Johnson at MIT's Sloan School of Management says critics of Wall Street's freewheeling ways before the financial crisis couldn't have a better weapon now.
The counterargument that some people on Wall Street have been making was, no, you don't need the Volcker Rule because we're all much more sophisticated than we were before, and the previous financial crisis weeded out bad practices. But now we're talking about supposedly the best bank on Wall Street with regard to risk management.
In coming weeks, the bank will surely try to stem its losses and clean up the mess. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
For analysis, let's bring in Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial. He's with us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Chris, how big of a deal is this?
Wow. A $2 billion loss is a big deal anywhere, and that's the place you have to start. But in this case, it's even bigger because J.P. Morgan has been, and particularly Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan, has been the champion pushing back against increased bank regulation here in the United States, really the only banker to speak out on that. And that's going to be a much harder argument to make today.
Does that mean, do you think, that we're going to see the Volcker Rule, the famous Volcker Rule, which prevents banks from trading with their own money?
Well, it does. You know, the rule has was part of the original Dodd-Frank law. Regulators say they are determined to write the rule and get it out there, but it's been delayed by months. It's proving very, very difficult to put into law because, you know, there are certain trading activities which should be allowed, and they can't figure out which is which. But certainly this morning, we're hearing a lot more voices calling for them to get moving and get that on the books.
And Chris, regulation aside, just from a financial perspective, is there a concern that there could be losses like this at other banks?
Well, there is. The Wall Street Journal in particular named names this morning, several big banks that had similar bets. This was primarily a bet on corporations, which would have benefited if Europe continued to recover. And of course, after the elections in Europe on Sunday, the European economy and European markets are thought at least to have suffered quite a bit. And that trade has gone bad, probably beyond J.P. Morgan.
That's Chris Lowe of FTN Financial in New York.
Well, the losses at J.P. Morgan are being attributed to a London-based trader named Bruno Iskill. He's also known as the London Whale, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The trader acquired his nickname as a result of his huge appetite for complex securities and his dominant role in the market. One flick of his tail, it was said, one spurt from his blowhole would send ripples around the globe. Well, the whale has now reportedly swamped J.P. Morgan with losses. His bets apparently went horribly wrong. But bank analyst Ralph Silver says it's not fair to pin everything on the whale. A lot of smaller fry may also be to blame.
So to say that it was specifically one trading desk is inappropriate because the positions actually move throughout the time zones. So when the markets close in the U.S., they move to Asia, and it literally goes around the world. So everyone was responsible.
Anyway, the losses will reverberate throughout the banking industry and make it harder to argue that tough new regulations should be watered down. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
A group of climate activists, including five teenagers, are suing the federal government. They head to court today using an unusual legal strategy to fight greenhouse gas emissions. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
Meet lead plaintiff Alec Lors.
I'm 17 years old, and I'm a climate change activist.
Here he is in a YouTube video about his lawsuit.
This is not about politics or money. This is about the survival of my generation.
Lors and four other teens say current levels of greenhouse gas pollution violate their right to a healthy environment in the future.
Saying, wait a minute, you've essentially used up some of the resources that we need.
Vicky Arroyo directs the Georgetown Law Climate Center. She says the case uses something called public trust doctrine to demand the U.S. cut carbon emissions by 6% a year. A decision in their favor would mean using a lot less oil and gas right away. Industry lobbyists say the power to dictate that sits with the Environmental Protection Agency, not a judge. Michael Gerard at Columbia's Center for Climate Change Law says the court will likely agree.
This is a major long shot.
He says Congress authorized the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases, not courts. But it's because Congress failed to pass climate change legislation that these kids are in court to begin with. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
So, Stacey, you know how advertisers are always going after that 18 to 34 demographic?
Oh, yes.
They want those young people, and it's not because they're going to spend more money than their parents. They probably don't have as much
right.
money as their parents. It's because if you hook consumers on a product while they're young, of course, they might just stay with it for a long time. Well, that was the theory, but it may not be the case anymore.
Really?
According to a recent study from WSL Strategic Retail, young people are not as brand loyal as their parents. Wendy Liebman is the CEO of WSL, and she joins us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So is brand loyalty a thing of the past?
It's not a thing of the past, but it's hard to gain and hold on to in these tough economic times. And so price is really the big message running across everybody's brow. And when they're thinking about price, they sometimes have to give up on brands they're loyal to.
So it's just about price. It's not that they wanted to buy whatever their friends like on Facebook or something like that. They are just looking for the cheapest option?
You know, everybody's certainly bombarded by lots of information. But one of the big issues, particularly for the younger generation, the so-called millennial generation, is the fact that they are really, really pressed financially at the moment. And so they're making different kinds of decisions than probably their older brothers or sisters or their parents did.
So does that mean that the old tactic by advertisers of basically getting you while you're young, getting you to pick Crest instead of Colgate toothpaste so that you'll always be used to that brand and you'll buy it for the rest of your life, is that model then not going to work for these millennials, as you say?
It's much more challenged. Certainly millennials want to be loyal, are interested in brands that serve their needs. But at the same time, they are thinking very differently about what's worth it to them now.
Well, what are the implications? It seems like this is going to have big effects on advertisers.
on advertisers, on retailers, on brands, and it requires a different kind of thinking today than did before. I mean, part of it is saying to people, it's not just it's hundreds of dollars, but it's hundreds of dollars because it's made with certain quality. It's made under certain restrictions, so it's not hurting people in other countries. All of this tells you why you need to buy it and why it's worth the price the manufacturer is asking for.
Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Do you ever feel like the results of your internet searches are skewed? Well, according to a new report commissioned by Google, the search giant has every right to pick and choose the results it wants to display.
UCLA Law Professor Eugene Volokh wrote the report, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Good to be on.
Well, tell us what your report found.
So the First Amendment protects the right of everyone to communicate the facts and opinions that they think are worth communicating. They could try to be objective. They could prefer those views that they think are better. They could have a mix of those things. More importantly, in a sense, it's not up to the government to decide what kind of communications are fair and objective and what kind of communications are skewed. Search engines actually believe that their expression is fair and objective even when there is some preference given to the search results that they themselves provide. But the First Amendment protects the rights of all speakers, whether it's the New York Times or whether it's an encyclopedia or guidebook or a search engine to convey those facts and opinions that they choose to convey and not others that the government would want them to convey.
Did you have any relationship, Professor, with Google in conducting this report?
Oh, yes, absolutely. This report is commissioned by Google. It is essentially a work of advocacy.
Well, then advocate me this, Professor. If Google wants to prioritize its own products in a search, is that really falling under their First Amendment rights?
Well, of course. Just like if, say, a newspaper decides that it wants to do television listings, as once upon a time all newspapers did, that might be very much in competition with other magazines, like, if you remember, TV Guide, which used to provide that. And the newspaper might put a little item on its front page saying, see this insert for this week's television listings, has the right to do that. And if TV Guide were then to go and say, no, we are entitled to be packaged with your newspaper, we are entitled to have you talk about us in as prominent a place in your newspaper as you talk about your own things, the answer is, well, of course not. Every newspaper has the right to choose what it includes and what it excludes and what it promotes on its front page of its own materials and what it doesn't promote of other people's speech. And the same thing is true of, as I said, other publications like encyclopedias, like guidebooks, and the same thing is true of a search engine.
So you're saying when people go to Google, they shouldn't expect that when they search for something that they're getting an objective look at some algorithm some computer figures out for them. They are, in fact, getting whatever Google wants them to see.
Well, remember, computers don't figure things out. Computers apply algorithms that are created by human beings who make choices as to what to include and what not to. When Google prioritizes certain kinds of items, it does so because it thinks that those are valuable for the reader to see. And more importantly, readers have to believe that too, because if readers think that a search engine's output is not useful to them, it's so easy to switch to another search engine. That is what really protects customers, is the fact that there are other search engines that it's easier than ever to switch to.
But critics of Google search practices have argued that the First Amendment doesn't allow companies to undermine competition.
Well, what they're essentially saying is they think that Google speech is unfair. The Google speech unfairly prefers certain things, whereas they would rather the Google speech were in some other way. And the answer is that the First Amendment does not entitle the government to police the fairness of speech.
Professor, I know this isn't a legal question, but isn't one of Google's tenets, don't be evil?
And Google thinks that what it's doing is, in fact, what is in the best interests of its users and will provide the users information that is most useful to them. And again, if users think that's unsound, if users think that's unfair or unhelpful to them, it's easier than ever for users to just switch to some other source.
Eugene Volokh is a professor of law at UCLA. Professor Volokh, thank you.
Very much my pleasure.
Well, Stacey, NBC is apparently trying to get Donald Trump to sign on for two more years as host of Celebrity Apprentice. That's according to the New York Post today.
He's not fired.
He may be rehired. Up until now, though, the Post says Trump has only been interested in one-year contracts, not two-year contracts, which makes me wonder if Donald would have made an exception for the standard four-year term required for that Washington, D.C. job he used to be interested in.
Documentary First Position opens this weekend. The film focuses on several young dancers competing in an international competition, the Youth America Grand Prix. But mostly, the film is about what it takes to be a professional dancer. Turns out, it takes a lot of hard work and a lot of money. At the Manhattan Movement and Arts Center, I caught up with Miko Fogarty, one of the dancers featured in the film. Wearing a black leotard and tights, she showed me her first position.
This is first position. It's where you're turned out and you're just standing with your knees together.
The film's director, Bess Cargman, grew up dancing ballet and made the movie because she wanted to understand what it took to go pro. But when she started making the film, she was shocked at how expensive it was.
Pointe shoes cost $80. Some kids go through a pair a day. The average price of a tutu is about $2,000. Miko's needed at least six this year.
And that's just the clothing. Miko's mother, Satoko Fogarty, says the real expense is the thousands they pay in competition entry fees and ballet school.
$35,000 for tuition, which includes class and private lesson, $35,000 a year. That's at least. It might be more.
Mrs. Fogarty estimates it all adds up to nearly $50,000 a year. For families that can't afford that stiff price tag, there are options. Director Bess Cargman says that's why she chose to profile one dancer from Colombia whose family is not wealthy.
While you don't necessarily have to be rich to make it as a dancer, you have to figure out a way to pay these costs. That's why scholarships for young dancers are so important.
And family support. Getting serious about ballet means lots of time on the road, picking up and dropping off and even moving.
A lot of times, dancers, their whole families move. They relocate to be closer to the ballet school, just as is the case with Miko. And frequently, parents have to take second and third jobs.
Miko's family moved to be closer to her ballet school. Her father paid to relocate his office. Even at 14, Miko is very aware of the sacrifices her family is making.
It's kind of weird thinking, like, your family just spends so much money. Yeah, it's just kind of weird hearing, like, everything, but it's reality, so.
Another reality? Even for dancers who do make it, salaries aren't high. Companies pay starting dancers about $60,000 a year, and the salaries don't go up much from there. But Satoko Fogarty says supporting her daughter is about more than money.
I don't know if I should say this one or not, but I think Miko is born to be a ballerina, so. And we are there to help make her dream come.
The Grand Prix competition gives out scholarship positions at ballet programs all over the world. This year, Miko placed 12th and got a scholarship at the Princess Grace School for Ballet in Monaco.
And it's such a huge deal because it's a scholarship. Like, you don't have to pay for, like, all the classes. And it's in France, right?
In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.